Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey. This is episode number 196. Super excited to have Jock Tavor with us today. Jock is the founder of Sirens and Titans Fitness out in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara. A great facility out there where he's trained a multitude of athletes, really specializing in working with elite cyclists. He's worked with USA Cycling. He competes at a high level himself. And just a real unique, cool guy. I mean, we had a chance to talk quite a bit, and just some of the things that he's doing, I'm really impressed with. So we dig into that. He's got a new book coming out where he details a lot of the different interval type training, isokinetic training that he does, which is different than the traditional long, slow distance oxidative training that goes along with endurance sports. So I think if you work with an endurance sport, you'll definitely enjoy this episode. Lots of great information in there, regardless of your discipline. Before we get to that, though, I want to make sure we recognize our sponsor, Sornex. As you know, they have Summer Strong each year. It is an event that I highly encourage you to attend. I'll be there. Marissa from my staff will be there. And many, many other coaches and high-level people. And it's a great weekend. I mean, it's a great weekend of fellowship, a great weekend of learning. And then of course, the expo side of things and the competition and things like that. And so, it is a must attend event in my opinion. And, we often say it's an experience, not a conference. And, I truly believe that. So if you are available, I would make sure that you're attending that. I hope to see you down there for that. The other weekends of the year, we have our play summits, and we have one coming up here pretty soon. And if you have not checked out playsummits.com, go to that. We just had Australia. By the time this goes up, it'll be Indianapolis. And then we have Atlanta, Baltimore, Denver, Toronto, Ireland, and then again in Woodstock later this year. So still plenty of events. Between Sornex, Summer Strong, and the Play Summits, you have quite a bit of continuing education opportunities. So make sure you support those, support Sornex and the rest of our sponsors, those that help make this for free each and every week for you, and sit back and enjoy this episode. All right, guys, welcome back. Super excited to have Jock Tavor with us. Jock is the founder of Sirens and Titans Fitness out in Santa Barbara, and an elite cyclist. He's trained with a variety of athletes and just gotten a chance to just briefly talk to him. We don't really know each other that well, so I'm excited to get him on and dig in to his story a little bit. But was introduced by Kirsten Martin with VersaClimber and just the unique things that he's doing out there with their product. But more specifically, he's got an upcoming book that I think we're going to dig into quite a bit here. And I'm super excited to read that. But Jock, I appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Ron.
If you could, just for people that don't know you as well, if you could kind of, go into your story a little bit, kind of what's the background, what got you into the weight room, and then, what's led you down this road?
Sure. I started as a wrestler in high school and then wrestled in college. And we used to do garage lifting, me and my buddies. One guy had a squat rack, one guy had a bench press. I don't know if you can think back far enough to those old concrete weights.
Heck yeah.
With the plastic around them.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that was a lot of our weightlifting. One guy had some curls, and you go from garage to garage in the summer out in the desert. And that's how I started lifting weights. And wrestling, I wrestled as a lightweight both in high school, and I wrestled at UC Davis at 118s and 125 pounds. I did some powerlifting tournaments while I was in high school. Our wrestling coach was a big weightlifter, so he actually organized some powerlifting tournaments way back then.
Wow.
So I was exposed to weightlifting at a very young age. I had a guy who was a senior when I was a sophomore, had this big, huge chest, and I go, I didn't get so strong. It was push-ups. I do push-ups. So I started doing hundreds of push-ups every night. So that's how I kind of got into the weight room, and have been doing it ever since, and I'm still doing push-ups. I I started by a buddy of mine had a center called Burt Sports Performance in Santa Monica, and he wanted me to take a look at it. They were having problems, so I turned it around. They're still in existence. But they had some really interesting equipment. They had Isokinetic equipment there, and it really got me intrigued about power and how power is produced, because it would measure the amount of power in foot-pounds on every jump or every press or whatever it is. So I really started noodling on power at that point in time, because I think it's something that really dictates a lot of what I do today, is, you know, learning about power back then. And we trained a lot of great athletes. Shaq at the time was training there. I worked with Gary Vee at the Lakers, and they took a piece of the equipment and put it into the training facility. So I got to see, you know, a lot with a lot of great athletes. What's the interesting thing about my background, I didn't have a mentor. I mean, I saw one of your guests, Lauren Landau, on the other day. And one of the things, I went and saw him at a strength conference down in Long Beach recently. And he said, I always like to thank all my mentors. And I thought it was a neat thing to do. And then I thought about it. I go, my mentors were books, textbooks. And I didn't come from the traditional background of strength and conditioning. So I just learned it, played Dr. Frankenstein, experimented on myself, read a lot, went to a lot of conferences, but I didn't have someone teaching me a certain way of doing things. And I think that that's an advantage. And I'll tell you why. I tell people that if you ever try to listen to English without hearing the words, it's very hard to do.
Yep.
You can't separate just the sounds from the words, because this is your language. And so I think it holds true also with strength and conditioning. Sometimes you have to look at it for the sounds and not the words, and then you're going to see it differently. And then you kind of have fresh eyes and you're going, well, why? Why are we doing this? Why aren't we doing it this way? So I think that that kind of a mentality has led me to understand and see things somewhat differently than other people in the industry. I've learned a lot from people, and there's nothing wrong with the tradition, but I think that you have to constantly be asking why. And we, in this industry, get very caught up with systems and not as much of thinking about why are we doing this system, you know? And so that's kind of my journey. I had a center in Santa Barbara, which I still do. Actually, I'm in LA right now, and we have a 7,000 square foot flagship center in Los Angeles, which is where I work out of right now.
Okay.
And so this is going to be the thrust of it. I have a great coach that is running the center in Santa Barbara now. So that's kind of my journey, and here I am. You know, I was fortunate at Vert. I trained a lot of athletes, really high caliber. Otto Bolden, when he was sprinting. A lot of the Lakers. I even had Sean Kemp when he came back. So all these different athletes from diverse backgrounds, and all on that isokinetic equipment. So I really had a good understanding of what power looked like measured.
Right.
It's one thing to look at an Olympic lift, and as a coach with a good eye, you can tell whether they're at their optimum power output or not.
Sure.
It's another thing to actually have it measured. And
Agreed.
Say, okay, wow, okay, and I can see how my strength side of the equation is impacting my power side of the equation. So that's my background, pretty much it. I race bikes now. So I went from wrestling to cycling.
Right.
And made a big jump to where, you know, we were doing 9-minute matches, and then going to 4-hour races and 3 or 4 day stage races, which is a completely different way of training. I always hated it because I would race against these guys that were little skinny, tiny guys. And I go, I want to get in the octagon at the end of the race. And,
that's right.
So we have a biathlon where you can maybe beat me up the hill, but then let's mix it up in an octagon. Hey. And see how you...
As a former wrestler myself, I completely agree with that. I completely agree with that.
You know what I'm talking about.
My son's a wrestler as well, but hey, there's a lot to dig in there. You know, I think, first thing is I obviously, without mentors, and even with mentors, this happens, but without mentors and just reading books and being and kind of Frankenstein in it, like you say, you have the opportunity to make lots of mistakes there, you know, with working with athletes and different systems and different programs and different things. What's maybe the biggest mistake you made and kind of how you learned from it?
I may get too deep in the data sometimes, I think. I think that, there's a place for both. And I think that if you, the practical application of something, you know, in theory, it sounds really good.
Right.
And, you know, I read a ton of science and I understand it, but in practicality, it may not be so appropriate. But the flip side of that is you're actually looking at seriously as to the reason why something is happening. So I think that initially I probably didn't translate the data as well as I think I could have now. And there's been an evolution of tying together those things. Because, like, for example, I think, you know, it's so funny, you know, this as a strength coach. You coach according to your own training right. and limitations. If you have a bad wrist, I got a bad wrist from crashing and biking. I don't like Olympic lifting as much as I used to.
Right.
So I have a tendency to shy away from it more sometimes when I'm coaching athletes, and I'll go to one-arm snatches and I'll do other stuff instead of a traditional Olympic lifts because of my wrist.
Yeah.
And so you start figuring out ways to do things differently. And so I try to make sure that I don't get too far away. That would be the other thing that I would say is a mistake is your training is often a reflection of your own experience in training because you're good at those things. And you have to be careful about not overlaying your skill set that you're good at onto an athlete that skill set doesn't apply.
Agreed. Agreed. I'm guilty of that as myself.
Yeah, I think every strength coach does it. And sometimes I have to look at my workouts and I write and design. One other thing I believe is the way you learn this business is by writing workouts. I mean, I don't think it's as in the gym is important because that's what you how you get the performance out of the athlete. But to learn how to get performance is program design.
Right.
You know, and I probably write 30 or 40 workouts a day. Now, the one thing I've never done is I've never had a gym like you have with 40 athletes at the same time.
Right.
You know, I'm always very high touch, 3 or 4 athletes max, you know, 1 or 2 when it's an elite athlete and that's it. And it's a lot different than when you're programming for 80 guys in a room.
Sure. Yeah. Obviously logistics are a big factor, but at the same time, you know, that's experience as well. I mean, you need to have the good science. You have to have the good program. And then from there, then it's just a matter of finding ways to make it work. But I couldn't agree with you more with both of those. I'm guilty of both of those as well. You mentioned earlier that you know, you were a wrestler, obviously you've been in martial arts, you've done lacrosse, you've worked with athletes. You mentioned basketball, quite a bit of basketball players there, obviously with USA Cycling and some elite level cyclists. What do you think prepared you best to be able to work with this variety of athlete?
I think I have a mentality of someone. I think you as a wrestler know it's a life sport. If you decide to quit, someone's going to kick the crap out of you. I mean, that's the way the sport works. And I think that mentality works well in coaching athletes. I think that athletes want someone that can tell them they can win and can guide them through this and understand and give them the confidence that their strength and conditioning, that the work has been done.
Right.
So that when they get on the field, they know I've done the work. I've done it harder than anybody else. Nobody's going to match this level of work and nobody's going to be as thorough as myself and Jacques in our program. So that's what I wanted. That's what I think, because I want to bring that to them, and I won't ever compromise that integrity. If I can't deliver to an athlete, I'm going to send them somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, it's not worth it to me because I really believe that the real thing a strength and conditioning coach, a great coach does is it sells the athlete time. That's what you would give an athlete.
Right.
If you think about it, there's a small window from 18 to probably 28 that they're at their peak performance. It's 10 years.
Right.
And if you say every off season you have 8 weeks, maybe, and with a pro athlete, you may not even get 8 weeks.
Right.
You may get 4 weeks or 5 weeks. So the value of that time, if you can have them be fitter and stronger earlier in their career, then their productive years are so much better so that by the time they're 28, they had all their good years from 18 to 26. And sure, you have the longevity if you do the right things, but if you waste that time, And this is what a lot of athletes don't understand, that time is the enemy.
Right.
And that the strength coach's job is to design a program that moves the needle further, faster, without injury, and then also helps to prevent it. But too many people get caught up with Instagram, and how does it look on Instagram, and how does it look here, and how does this exercise look, as opposed to saying, how am I managing the optimum efficiency of time that I have with my athlete so I can get the best performance so that he's further ahead? And, you know, and you also have to take into account risk.
Right.
If you try to push it too far, too fast, then the risk of injury starts to escalate, and then you're not doing the athlete any good. You're cutting the time back on them because they get hurt.
Sure.
So I really believe that what we do is we provide time to the athlete to have a more productive career through strength and conditioning. That's how I see it.
That's the number one reason I would give the pro athletes that I worked with, you know, as a reason for why I should be in their life, was the fact that we could help them stay on the field longer, you know.
And, exactly.
No question. Well, you talked about isokinetic training quite a bit there at the beginning, right. And just you kind of, you know, obviously the evolution of growing as a coach and then turn around and incorporate that in a big, big way in your programs. For the coaches that maybe don't know what you're talking about, you know, define it, and then kind of why is it such a big part of your program?
Well, the isokinetic equipment just gave me – isokinetic equipment is accommodating resistance. So it's tied to a computer. Usually you're on a machine that's hydraulic in nature, like a Kaiser machine or something like that. And Kaiser actually is building power into some of their machines now, so you can measure it. If you were doing a jumping motion with two pads on your shoulder, it measures the speed to peak force. It measures what the acceleration phase of the movement is. It'll give you a bell curve in terms of how quickly you get up to peak force, and then how much total power is produced. And power is usually measured in watts or foot-pounds. Yep. Or something like that. On an isokinetic machine, it measures it in foot-pounds. So if I was to say that there's one thing that I think that needs more attention in our industry, it's the measurement of power. I think that a lot of people confuse strength and power and spend way too much time on strength and not enough time on power.
Mm-hmm.
And then how to measure. So I think that I'm interested in power because I believe that all roads lead to power. It's just an X factor of power.
Sure.
If you're a shot putter, it's six throws. If you're a high jumper, it's six or seven jumps. That's all it is. It's absolute power. If you're a 100-meter dash runner, it's absolute power. But if you're a pro basketball player, what wins the game is not how high you jump in the first quarter. It's how high you jump in the last.
Right.
So it's sustainability of power over longer periods in time is what usually wins any event that lasts longer than 10 seconds.
Agreed.
And that's what, so I started getting really intrigued with why are we as a strength coach community focused so much on absolute. If you look at most people, say, I'll improve your vertical jump. I get you to jump higher, one time. So we'll add 3 inches to your vertical jump. But that doesn't win a game.
Right.
It's a component of it. But what really wins the game is what is the highest percentage of that absolute power that you can sustain throughout the game. And so I started looking at that differently because most people will just do some kind of endurance power, power endurance for a period of time. And I turned it on its head and I said, what if I can get you, and I learned this on this isokinetic equipment, what if I can get you to sustain power by producing maximum power over long periods of time by toying with the rest between the reps.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you were to look at as a strength coach, you say, okay, well, how many reps can I get on an Olympic, on a power clean at maximum in a row? Six, maybe,
right.
Four, six, not many more than that.
Sure.
Then they start to fatigue. They can't keep the speed on the bar up. So
right.
You go, okay. So that's all you can do. So I said, what if you just did three power cleans, rested for 5 seconds, three again, rested for 5 seconds, three again, rested for 5 seconds. It's been done on the strength side with cluster sets.
Yep.
where someone will do a cluster set to bump, you know, strength dramatically, but they'll keep the same weight and then they'll rest to get ATP replacement. Then they hit it again and they rest and they hit it again. It's a great way to add strength, but no one's done it with power.
Right.
So I started toying on the isokinetic equipment. And in the book, it talks about how when I first would do it, I would do like three sets of six jumps. I would get 2,700 foot-pounds of total jumping. And then I ended up by resting between the reps, I would do 4 minutes straight, 60 jumps at max power. So what your body does is it keeps firing and recruiting greater and greater muscle fiber in order to accommodate the max jump.
Right.
So you don't jump any higher. But what happens is then your first jump, you're using less energy to produce that first jump in the game.
Sure.
And then by the last jump, everyone else is fading and you're still producing max power. So that's how I got interested through the isokinetic equipment. I started discovering a lot of things because I could really experiment and see how it translates into power. And it's not the best because it's linear. There's no stability involved in an isokinetic machine. There's a lot of gaps and problems and things that I don't like about it.
Right.
But there's a lot of things I do like about it because it allows me to measure output.
Sure. You know, you obviously as an elite cyclist, I mean, most of the time if you're preparing for a marathon or a four hour bike race that's multiple days, I mean, you're doing long, slow distance training. You know, you're really spending a lot of this time in oxidative state and that's just a kind of general thing. We were talking off camera. You're saying that if you went to the NSCA, you see a bunch of guys with bald heads and goatees. And if you go to the cycling convention, you see a bunch of guys that you could throw on your hip and, you know, take it wherever you want. That the mentality of that, you know, is hard to break in that deal. But that's exactly what you've done with your book and with your training is shortened down to this, you know, these intervals, shorter rides, you know, trying to find the best way to sustain power over time. And you're writing a book about it. Tell us a little bit about the idea behind it and more about the book.
Yeah. The idea behind it was I felt that the endurance athlete, both whether you're a runner or a cyclist or whatever, and I consider endurance really anything over 10 seconds long. It's when you have to sustain power for longer than just at an absolute level. That's the way I look at endurance. So a 200 meter runner has to have the highest percentage of their 100 meter time the longest.
Right.
That's the way I look at it. And that's because, so that's sustaining that maximum power as long as you possibly can. And that's how I look at it. And so, but with most traditional endurance athletes, their coaching staff isn't spent much time in a weight room. And so they don't understand that. And what the flip side is what you just said is that most strength and conditioning coaches are going to try to jerry-rig a workout that's good for, you know, a defensive lineman and then apply it to a 120-pound cyclist that's, you know, sustaining power and heart rate for at such a high level for so long. So I'm trying to bring those two together. And what's interesting about it is I've become a better strength coach for the defensive lineman by understanding endurance training. It's really, there's a lot of symmetry in how your body works. And I'll give you a quick example. VO2 max is the maximum amount of oxygen you can deliver. I would equate that to vertical jump on the power side of the equation.
Right.
So if you were to say that, you know, your vertical jump is the highest amount of power per weight that you can generate in a jump, and VO2 max is similar. And then oxygen utilization, how much of the percentage of that VO2 max you can hold for how long, would be very similar to what percentage of your power you can hold for how long in a particular. So there's all these symmetries that you start seeing when you start exploring both sides of the equation. And I think a lot of strength coaches shy away from it because there's a conflicting concurrent training. You get conflicting hormones and they're going, oh, it's going to reduce our ability to increase strength and increase power. So they shy away from, spending any time on that. So this gap for the endurance athlete is what the book revolves around, is that they're kind of stuck in the middle. They're trying to figure out, how do I do a strength training program? And most of the programs that I've done a lot of research on them, it's going to be a lot of core work, some lower body work, very little power, maybe some box jumps. And what you also have to understand about most runners, weak upper bodies. So even if you can get, I went to the World Cup at the Velodrome here over the weekend, and the legs on the guys are just like they look like bodybuilders. But in many cases, they don't have the upper body strength to overload the hips enough.
Right.
So you go to plyos instead, and then you can't measure the output, and it becomes another problem.
Right.
So endurance athletes kind of stuck in the middle, and this book addresses a lot of those issues. And I think they all come back to how do you measure the power and how do you develop power for longer periods of time. I mean, there's a myth that European cyclists won't even carry their own luggage because they don't want to put any upper body size on. You know, they're so concerned. You get around a bunch of cyclists, you laugh at it because you'll go back to your wrestling days when, you know, you're trying to make weight and you go and your teammate says, "Hey, you look kind of skinny, Ron." "Do I? Really? Oh, great." "Trying to make weight." You know, cyclists are like, you know, running around going, "Oh, I look skinny. Oh, that's wonderful." And right. In the weight room, you don't hear that much.
That's
true. Most guys won't look big. So I'm trying to bridge that gap between strength and conditioning in the traditional sense, endurance training in the traditional sense, and bridge the gap for the endurance athlete. And I also think that it's also a way to train, as I said, for people that have to extend power even at the highest level for 20 or 30 seconds.
Right.
I think the training is the same. The difference is the power output is just greater. It's at a much higher.
You know, when you dig into the actual workouts, you know, what's different about them? And I know that you've used tools like the VersaClimb, VersaPulley. You've used a lot of different interval type pieces of equipment. What was different about the workouts that we're going to read in this book?
I'll give you an example. I use the VersaPulley here. I don't use isokinetic equipment here anymore. I just use the VersaPulley. There's the problems with isokinetic equipment. They're high maintenance pieces of equipment. They're like Ferraris that you have to constantly
put on.
Because they're mainly used for laboratories.
Sure.
You know, a lot of labs use them for testing muscles and stuff like that. So it's easier in a lab setting. But when you got a lot of people, they wear out fast. The difference is traditional power and power endurance would be, like I said, maybe you would do 3 sets of some power exercise, 6 to 8 rep sets, and then maybe on another day you would do some power endurance where you would be doing multiple jumps. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that those multiple jumps are at a suboptimum level once you get over about 8 jumps, because the power output diminishes. You get to 15 or 20 jumps, and maybe you're doing 60% of your max output at best. So what I do, I use the VersaPulley because it has this thing called an IPU, initial power unit, that measures the power being pulled on the rope.
Flywheel, yeah.
So on the flywheel, exactly. So what I do is I'll first work on developing absolute power. So I'll have an athlete, he'll do 6, you know, eccentric exercises where we're trying to measure the power in his hips. So he'll do 6 hip hinges or 6 what I call a short row, where it's all hips on the machine. And let's say he has a maximum output of 500 IPUs. So that's the baseline. That's my absolute power. I'm not going to get him much more. I'm not going to turn him into a weightlifter. He's a cyclist. And then what I do is because he has an endurance base, because he's an endurance athlete, I'll pull 4 pulls at close to 500. So he'll do 4 pulls in a row, close to 500, and then we rest for 10 seconds. Mm. And then he does another 4 pulls at close to 500. And my rule of thumb is if I drop below 10% or 50 IPU units, if he got down to 450, I would stop him, because then he's starting to get a suboptimum. And with guys who have done it for a while, they'll do 4 minutes of this straight. Their heart rate is jacked. They're pulling close to 450 to 500 on every single pull. So at the end, they've done 60 or 70 or 80 pulls at max output. So what the body does, the body accommodates every time you ask it to pull at max output.
Right.
It's going to recruit greater and greater muscle fiber in order to produce this max output. So that's what I do with a cyclist. Now, when I had Cassius Marsh in here, we were doing only 45 seconds of that, but he was pulling close to 600.
Right.
So he would do three pulls or four pulls at 600, rest for 10 seconds, another four pulls. So I would match it to what would be the case in a long play on the field. So if he's having to explode and then shake a defensive lineman and then shake another one and shake another one before he finally gets the quarterback, you know, he may have six or eight explosions in that time, but I don't want any of them to diminish.
Right.
So I just adapt it based on the length of time of the particular athlete.
Sure.
And then I'll also work on the velocity side of the equation. So I'm looking at force, you know, distance divided by time, the velocity side, to come up with power, and then what I call MSP, which is maximum sustainable power. So at what rate can they sustain it? Now you're getting some more. So I used to use the Tensor. Do you remember that
piece of equipment? Yeah, absolutely.
You don't see it as much because it's kind of awkward. It's a little hard to use. You got to enter everything in. But now I saw this new company that's coming out with something where it's tied to your wrist on an accelerometer, and they're measuring power on Olympic lifts through that and an iPhone. So one of the limitations of doing this with Olympic lifts is it's hard to measure the speed.
Right.
You know, it's much harder. You have to have a coach like you or someone that's really seen a lot to say, nope, 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 you're slowing down too much, we're done.
Right.
And you can see the power dropping off. So I use a lot of walking lunges when someone doesn't have the VersaPulley available.
I got you.
It's an easy one to measure power output on. You can kind of judge your speed on a walking lunge a little better, and it's less risk of getting in trouble. So that's the protocol.
I like that.
So everything that leads up to it would be very traditional, you know, big heavy lifts, you know, all of the mobilization, all of the stabilization, all those things to develop a really solid foundation of developing force. And then how do I develop the next foundation, which may include a lot of Olympic lifts and everything else to get max power output?
Right.
And then I say, okay, once I've developed that base, I'm not going to, you know, spend any more time on it other than maintaining it. And then the rest of the time is spent on holding power for longer periods of time. So that's how I do it.
Oh, that's great. Very interesting. Well, give me, I know the book is Bicycling Magazine's Maximum Overload. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Available on Amazon?
It's on Amazon right now. It'll be actually printed and available, but you can pre-purchase it on Amazon right now.
That's
Rodale
great.
Press, who publishes Bicycling Magazine's Men's Health, Runner's World, they're the publisher.
That's great. That's great. Well, man, well, this has been fantastic. We end the show with some resources. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Yeah, I would have to say that it probably came from my father. I know it sounds funny, but my father would yell at us constantly to think for ourselves. Think for yourself, think for yourself, think for yourself. Until we argued with him, and then he didn't like it so much.
That's right.
And then the other thing that he would say is question everything. So as a coach, if you think for yourself and you question everything, it makes for great coaching.
Great.
Because you're looking at things and even my own, I'm constantly trying to review my own work as I'm saying, where are the gaps? So I'm tough on myself. I don't just get into this, you know, soft zone where I go, I got all the answers.
Right.
I don't. You know, this, as you know, this business is really complicated. It's a constant state of learning. That's probably the best piece of coaching advice because it allowed me then to become a better coach by thinking for myself and then questioning everything. And I wrote a blog article that said that if everything that we know about training and nutrition today was wrong, how would you train and eat?
Right.
Because 40 years ago, we were doing some stuff that was completely wrong.
That's right.
So you have to always be asking yourself, if I was to look at it through that lens, how would I see what I'm doing today?
That's great.
And that came from my father. That's kind of how I did it.
So that's where some of the best advice comes from, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What about a book, app, and website recommendation?
Yeah, I love Mel Siff Super Training. I mean, that's a classic for any strength and conditioning. You can read it, reread it, read it, reread it. I love Piers Astrand, Work physiology book. It's unbelievable. And that is, I think, is a better book for someone who wants to train more endurance types of athletes, because sure. they've done a lot of research on endurance athletes. And then the last one is more of a business book.
Okay.
It was written in the 40s by a guy who was actually a pro baseball player. And back then, when you didn't make it as a baseball player, you became an insurance salesman. You go, and this was in the 40s, and they literally went door to door knocking on people's doors. So he wrote this book. His name is Frank Becker, B-E-T-T-G-E-R. And the book's title is How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success in Selling. And it's you can read it in about 45 minutes, but it is the best sales book. It's been translated into hundreds of different languages. He used to tour around with Dale Carnegie. I found it in a thrift store originally on a shelf in a hardback version, but you can buy it for probably, it'll be the best 12 or 14 bucks you ever spent. You can still get it on Amazon. But if you want to understand selling, and it still applies today in terms of, you know, identifying key issues and these kinds of things. So I think that's probably one of the best business books I've read. And that's awesome. I have an MBA, and I've read a lot of business books, but this one is a classic. I give it to any young guy that's starting out. I go, it's something that you should read because it's easy and it's past the test of time.
That's awesome. Yeah, principles, yeah. right? Principles yeah, never go exactly. away. Yeah, exactly.
And the Chris Beardsley Strength and Conditioning Research website is awesome. It was one of your guests. Who's the guy, the glute guy? What's his name?
Brett Contreras.
Brett Contreras.
Yeah.
They both are involved in it. I think it's 10 bucks a month.
Yeah.
And it gives you all the research you can't even read it all. It's a wonderful resource.
That is.
It's a wonderful resource. So that would be my one website that I would say that I would go to if I was, looking to get information at a really reasonable price.
That's great, man. Well, this has been fantastic. I took three pages of notes here as you were talking, and I hope I didn't get too far
in the weeds on some of that. I know it's
a little complicated. I think it's exactly what it was. And again, I mean, I think getting your book and digging into it a little bit more is going to be fantastic. We talked about your book. What about where can people go to stay up to date with what you have going on?
You can go to our website, sirensandtitansfitness.com. I publish the blog. I write a lot of blogs. One of the things that I think that if you look at the three legs of the intellectual stool, it's, reading.
Yep.
Writing and dialogue. So these kind of conversations. So I try to write a blog. Sometimes no one will read them. They're just very sciencey, and maybe a guy like you would find it interesting, but most people don't. But what I do is I do it more for myself, because if you write, you really have to think about the subject if you know people are going to be reading it, and then having discussion with someone who's a peer or someone that has a different perspective is of great knowledge. You can't just read it all. You have to look at both of those. And then the ultimate one, I think, is teaching.
Exactly. Point,
you teach, you really learn the subject. But I think writing kind of substitutes for teaching. So that's why I like those looking at it that way.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to come back with teaching. I think that's the absolute best way to retain information for sure, and be able to deliver it.
It's funny, just to close, this business, as you know, there's a lot of ego. Everyone thinks they know everything. And there's a lot of fear that I don't want to disclose any secrets or anything. I'm an open book.
Yeah.
Anybody that listens to this podcast and wants to know what I'm doing, they can come in here and watch, and I'll tell them everything I can possibly tell them.
That's great.
I don't look at this as this is my knowledge to hold and protect. I want to share it as much as I possibly can. I think it makes us better as an industry. I think it makes you better as a strength coach if you share that. So anyone that's interested, just hit me up and I'll give you everything I got.
That's exactly why I do this show, because I think I agree 100% that it's so important it's hardly an original thought a lot of times. It's just, it's basically taking information and being able to practically apply it somehow. And there's lots of different ways to do that.
100%.
Obviously,
yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on, man. And it's obviously a testament. I can see why Kirsten recommended you so strongly. And I took tons of notes. I know everybody else will too. So appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.
Okay, buddy. We'll talk soon.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.